I'm Daniel Vitalis of DanielVitalis.com, and you are listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast, a show dedicated to transcending human domestication, activating our invincible genetic health, and uncovering our true potential. In each episode, we explore the many aspects of the rewilding lifestyle for better health, fitness, and a more rich and fulfilling life. Rewild yourself. Engage your biology. Welcome back to the Rewild Yourself podcast. Hey, this show is made possible by surthrival.com. That's SURTHRIVAL.com, like the word thrive mixed into the word survive. SurThrival is a product line I've built over the last 6 years. Very high-end, very clean, whole food extracts and supplements that are built around the rewilding philosophy. They're supplements that I've personally became interested in trying to restore my body from what I think of as the ravages of domestication. So if you're interested in that, check out SurThrival, and that company really makes this show possible. Also want to say it's about 2 weeks away from my elementary school program, which will be at the Omega Wellness Center in Rhinebeck, New York, October 11th through the 16th. Get over to DanielVitalis.com, click on my About and then Coming Events page, and you'll get the details for that if you'd like to join me there. Hope you do. And looking forward, if you're a listener and you're planning on being there, really excited to meet you in just a couple weeks. So, wow, what an awesome eclipse the other night. If you had the opportunity to see the blood moon, wow, that was amazing. I ended up, I don't have a telescope here where I'm living, so I used a tripod and duct taped some binoculars onto it. If you've ever looked at the full moon through binoculars, you know, it's pretty impressive. Just that little bit of magnification really brings out all of the cratering in the moon. So it was really awesome to watch that shadow of the Earth move across the face of the moon. And also just to think that that shadow that we were seeing, I mean, your body's part of the mass of the thing that's making that shadow. It's like, that's our shadow. It was wonderful to watch that, really humbling. It's like such a nice reminder of our place in things, of our size and scale when we watch the events that take place in the heavens like that. So really, really nice. It was the equinox the other day, my birthday. So I turned 37 years. 37 trips around the sun, as I like to often say, or one of my favorite ways to word that, instead of asking people, hey, how old are you? I like to say, how many years ago were you born? So I was born 37 years ago on the autumnal equinox, and that means summer has ended and we have shifted into autumn. So late spring, I put a challenge out to everybody, a no tan line challenge. So now is the time to look yourself over and see how you did this summer, accumulating vitamin D, accumulating melanin in your skin. Did you make it through the season without tan lines? Well, I should say, are you tan without tan lines? Because lots of people have no tan lines, but that's simply because they have no tan. So hope you made it through. Check yourself out. See how you did. Maybe make a commitment to next year as well. It's so important that we manufacture as much of that vitamin D and store up as much of it as we can as we move into what's coming here, these shorter days, darker days, winter months. Really important that we are topped up on our fat-soluble hormone we call vitamin D. Exciting show today because I'm going to do it solo. We are doing it solo. And I want to talk about 8 taboos that I think really stand in the way of most people's development into real human adulthood. I think we have a lot of old children in our world. I think we have a lot of elder kids, but we don't really meet a lot of adults with wisdom. They're out there. I have a lot of them on this show. But what I tend to encounter, and maybe you'll agree, are a lot of people who've had the opportunity to become fully developed humans, but maybe didn't seize that opportunity. And maybe a lot of people who never knew those opportunities were there. I think that's really, really common. So I'm going to talk about 8 things that really stand out to me, especially from having done this show for about 1.5 years now, and getting to bring so many experts in to talk about things that often go undiscussed. And you'll see as I go through these 8 topics that many of them, you know, you'll know people who have confronted them or confronted some of them, but maybe not all of them. So somebody might have really developed in one area, but there's sort of a vacuum or a weakness in another area. And so I want to invite you as the listener to start looking at all these areas. I'm guessing if you're a listener of this show, you know, if you've been following this work at all, then you're probably on this path. So this could be a little opportunity for a self-check-in or self-audit. And as I talk, note if there's areas where you're like, oh, that area for me triggers some stuff. Because we want to be as fully well-rounded, as fully developed as we can be. And I think that nobody's going to do this work for us. We have to seek it out because the way, you know this, the way our culture's set up, it's just all of these things get pushed to the side and pushed to the side in our human factory farm we call civilization, and we make it all the way to the end of our lives, sometimes never having really confronted these things. So I want to invite you to just really look deep. All right, let's get into it. First one I want to bring up is diet, and when I say that, I don't just mean what we eat, but I want to talk about our whole digestive tube and our relationship to the way we process things there. Lots of people step into the nutritional arena at some point in their life, so it's not like people don't confront diet or go on diets, but I want to go a little bit deeper than that. So first thing I want to say is it's really helpful to imagine ourselves as a tube that extends from our lips to our anus. That's one long tube, right? So the digestive tract, the alimentary tract, is not made of lots of interlocking individual organ parts the way we're often taught, but really is one long tube with no clear separations, right? The stomach doesn't plug into the small intestine. It's one long continuous tube. We can call the different parts of it different organs, and that's fair, but it's easy to think about it as made up of all these different little sections of tube, and reality is we are one long tube. So it's not just the food we put in, but it's also what's coming out on the other side. I think most people have a taboo around their digestive function. So it's not just the foods that we eat, but it's also the sounds that our digestive tract makes, right? It's the smells that come out of us. It's the fact that we have to defecate, and we get a little weird and squeamish and uncomfortable with that. So I want to invite you to really start looking at not just what you eat, but how you relate to your own digestive function and that of other people, right? Because there's what we put in the tube, there's what happens inside the tube, and those are the kind of sounds that we hear. Those are the gases that are made and we fart back out. That's the feces that develops in there and comes back out. We often don't have a real great relationship to that, and we kind of avoid really ever having to discuss it with other people. We feel really uncomfortable in a new place when we have to go to the bathroom. We often don't have really developed maturity around that, right? You hear somebody fart and it's like, we giggle and get all weird because we're uncomfortable. We're not really used to having adult conversation about this. Kind of a strange behavior, I think, given that most of us are going to the bathroom at least once every single day and we're eating, let's say, 3, 4, 5 times a day, and we act so strange about this whole thing. So you are a tube, right? And let's just kind of break down how this works a little bit. You take the body or body parts of something that was alive and is now dead. I mean, that's what food really is. So let's just get really honest about that. Food is the body parts of something that's dead. And I get kind of endlessly frustrated with people who think that the body parts of some dead creatures are immoral, but the body parts of other dead creatures aren't. So, you know, you've got people who think that, you know, eating lettuce and broccoli and kale and cabbage and tomatoes and quinoa, that that's ethical, but eating the body parts of pigs and chickens and sheep and deer, well, that's unethical. To me, this is a really weird approach, this idea of speciesism, where we think certain species have certain kind of value and other species are somewhere else in the hierarchy of the value of life, like the body parts of, like killing a carrot plant has some kind of lesser moral or lesser karmic value than killing a deer. I think this is a really strange way to approach life, especially because when we look at food from a mature perspective, we see that everything that gets eaten is the cell structure, is the body part of something, and that something wants to survive and replicate itself as well. So life is feeding on life. The nature of eating is predatory. And I think that's the first thing we really need to make peace with. Second thing I think we need to understand is that our tube, again, the lips to the anus, is filled with creatures that are not us, that are not you. It's filled with microbes, bacteria, yeasts, viruses that live all through your tube. And that you are not just a person, you are an ecology. And you're not just feeding you're feeding them. Your digestive process is some of you doing your own chemical work on food, like in your stomach with hydrochloric acid that you produce there. But then it's also a lot of the other things eating the food you ate. And by the time that food works through your system, where you've produced gases, but not really you, it's those organisms are eating your food and they're producing gases like methane. And that's what our farts are. I mean, that is the exhaust of the consumption of our foods by our microbes. And I think even more interesting is that when we finally go to the bathroom, when we have a bowel movement, when we shit, what's actually happening is we are mostly releasing the dead bodies of those microbes. There is just so many living creatures inside of us that just their dead bodies make up the greater percentage of what our bowel movement actually is. So that's not the food coming out the other end of you. Very little of the, if you're eating quality food, very little of that food needs to come out the other side. I mean, it's mostly the insoluble fibers and things like that make it, the fiber that makes it back out. But primarily, what you're releasing there are the sloughed off cells of the inside of your digestive lumen, of your tube, and the bodies of those microbes. So this is something you're going to do every day or should be doing every day. Would it be nice to be doing it every day? Often, many of us, it's more than once a day. And I think it's just a thing we need to get comfortable discussing, talking about, looking at. I think you should have a relationship to your bowel movements. I know this may sound strange because it's taboo, but that can tell you a lot about what's going on inside yourself. So, first taboo, make peace with the fact that you've got to kill to eat. Something's going to die for you to live. That's just reality for us and all the other living things of the world. And on the way back out is going to come something that maybe doesn't smell great, that maybe you have a natural aversion to. We should have that aversion. It keeps us healthy. But we don't need to make it taboo and pretend it's not happening and act like we don't and on and on and on. So first thing, make peace with that. People who don't, kind of, I find a little bit awkward. People who have lots of strange kind of food objections, people who object to the fact that things die for them to eat, people who are super awkward and uncomfortable about their bathroom habits, people who can't talk about that, to me, feel like children. And it's really nice to be around mature adults who can have a conversation about it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's still not funny and silly and awkward. It is, for sure it is. But at least we can have the conversation like mature human adults. Number two. Violence. I like this one. I'm just endlessly amazed at the way that so many of us deny the existence of violence in the world. The way that so many people are afraid to even communicate about it. This to me is another sign of immaturity. Now, one of the things that you'll notice is that the people who often want to avoid ever communicating about the fact that there's violence in the world all the time, every day, all around us, often call themselves conscious. So they like to talk about how conscious they are and how unconscious it is to talk about things like this and how they're so conscious that they only attract goodness and so they don't have to even know that that exists. And it's conscious, conscious, conscious. Well, the reality of consciousness is the idea of being conscious is being awake and being aware of what's happening around you. It's the ability to monitor your environment. And anybody who can get real about monitoring their environment can understand that violence exists all around us and has since all the way back. And we're not going to reach a place in time where violence ceases to exist. I mean, this is just a ridiculous concept. As we talked about in taboo number one, talking about diet, just the nature of food consumption is violent. Things die so that other things can live. And nature has built into itself this kind of predatory reality. It's just, we can't avoid it. And we are not just gathering apes, we are hunting and gathering apes. Fascinating to watch chimpanzees hunt other primates, kill them, and eat them. And a real wake-up call for me. I think it's a real wake-up call for people who are vegetarians and seeing, wait a second, oh man, this exists in nature, in our closest relatives. To see tribal peoples hunt and kill prey. I mean, this is just part of our reality. And even in apes that eat less meat, we see them, and it's most of us are pretty comfortable with the fact that they kill and eat things like termites, let's say, right? So we'll see them put a stick down into a termite mound, pull out those termites, and eat them. Now, that might not strike you initially as violence, but if you're the termite or you're the ant, that's definitely violent. Now, here's a reality that we just got to get real about. Every day, all around us, people are being murdered, people are being raped, people are being beaten, people are being abused. That's just a fact. That just exists. Acting like it doesn't exist is incredibly immature to me. Not being aware of threats in your environment seems just ridiculous. You know, if I lived in a place where there were cliffs everywhere, for me to say, well, there's just no cliffs, I mean, that would be ridiculous. That'd be a threat in my environment I'd want to be aware of. Doesn't mean I'd have to walk around in fear all the time. Doesn't mean I'd have to constantly be nervous about it. It's just awareness. That's consciousness, by the way. So I think this is one of these areas where people avoid it because they're actually worried. Well, yeah, they're actually worried that if they look at it, they're going to live in fear and terror. So they then kind of try to flip the equation and say, oh, that only happens to people who attract it, or that only happens if you focus on it, and I choose not to focus on it, therefore it won't happen. And one of the things I love to do is drill down on people. I'll ask questions like, when was the first time you saw violence? Have you ever been in a fight? When was your first fight? Have you ever been mugged? Have you ever been robbed? Have you ever been raped? Have you ever been molested? Have you ever been abused? Have you ever been threatened with violence? And when you drill down on people, you'll find that most of us have experienced violence at some point because it's incredibly common. Incredibly common. And yet, those same people will then kind of say, oh, that only exists if you attract it. It's like, well, you have experienced it. It's just, you know, it's just part of reality. Now, my experience is that the more we are willing to look at this, the less likely we are to encounter it because we start to actually be conscious of our environment. So who's more likely to fall off the cliff, the person who says there's no cliffs around or the person who becomes vigilant and aware of the cliffs around them? That person, to me, the latter person, is much less likely to slip off the edge because they're paying attention to it. So I think there's a real maturity in accepting that we live in a world that can be violent, and we live in a world that can be incredibly safe and beautiful too. Both of those exist simultaneously. They're not mutually exclusive. Accepting violence in the world does not mean we have to be the victims of violence, does not mean we have to perpetuate violence. It just is an acceptance of what is. Number three, nakedness. Ah, I love this one. I brought it up with the Naked Suntime Challenge that I did over the summer, encouraging people to get outside naked. Now, fascinating to see how people act around nakedness. Most people, I forget this sometimes, but most people have not had the experience of being naked socially. So most people's nakedness experiences happen when they're infants and toddlers. And then after that point, they almost always have clothes when they're around somebody else, unless they're alone and naked in the shower or maybe in bed, or they're with their sexual partner. And so there's a tendency to associate nakedness with being alone and with sex. And because of that, there's often this idea that there's something sexual about nakedness, when if you think about it, there's actually nothing sexual about it. Nakedness is just the default setting of all living things. mean, all living things are naked. They start off naked and they end off naked. And we happen to put clothes on. That doesn't change us being naked under those clothes, of course. That has nothing to do with sex. It's not like, you know, squirrels see other squirrels naked and it just, oh man, it really gets them turned on. It's like, that's just the default setting. For us, there tends to be a sexual component because we've simply associated it to sex in a kind of Pavlovian way, because it's the only time we're ever really naked. I really think it is valuable to, I think it's incredibly valuable, to go somewhere at some point in your life where nakedness is social. So that could be a nudist beach, or that could be, I have experienced this a lot at hot springs. It could be that you just have friends who are comfortable to sunbathe naked. Whatever it is, I think it's really important to be naked in contexts that are social and that don't have a sexual component to them. Why is that important? Because otherwise we walk around with this silly childish taboo and a fear of our own nakedness, a true fear. I mean, it's so fascinating to watch. Have you ever had maybe a friend over and you need to change real quick your clothes and you have that sort of awkward thing of where you're going to go do it, because if they see you naked, it could be really awkward and uncomfortable. There's all this sort of strangeness around it. It's kind of like what I was saying before about when people have to take a shit and there's somebody around and we get all weird about it and uncomfortable and we can talk about it. It's kind of like that. Well, that strangeness is a really good indicator that we've got, one, a taboo functioning, and two, a kind of immaturity around something that's really, really normal. The fact that most people at some time in their life, or many people often in their life, are looking at naked people maybe on the internet or in magazines, or in the past it would have been on DVDs, in the form of pornography, kind of is also interesting to me, because there's the component of wanting to see other people have sex. I mean, that's one of the big things with pornography. But I think another piece is just wanting to see naked people, because we don't have any way to calibrate what even is normal. Are we normal? I don't know. Can't tell. Is my body normal? I mean, everybody else is wearing clothes all the time. I'm wearing clothes all the time. It's also interesting to note the way that clothes can inhibit our ability to actually be healthy, because they can block our ability to get enough vitamin D. So in addition to the fact that we have this kind of embarrassment about our nakedness, we're also then suffering from a vitamin D deficiency caused by our clothing, and then we end up with movement inhibitions caused by our clothing as well. And by that, that's kind of obvious that, you know, most of our pants, for instance, will restrict our ability to actually use the full range of motion of our hips and thighs. You know, most belts are going to inhibit the free motion of the ilium bones of the pelvis. Women's bras, I think, a really great example of a piece of clothing that can be very detrimental to a person's health if they don't figure out ways to mitigate it, because of things like the underwire of the bra cutting off the delicate lymphatic flow of the breasts, which are lymphatic tissue, or the way that you'll see the strap of the bra of a woman who has large and heavy breasts, you'll see actually like a separation in the acromioclavicular joint that starts to happen on the top of the shoulder after a time, where the clavicle and the shoulder blade, the scapula, start to separate, right, because of all the stress on that ligament there. The way that a tight bra can restrict breathing. Another example, the way shoes restrict the mobility of the bones of the feet and the development of the musculature of the feet functioning like a cast. I'm not saying we should give up our clothing. I see the use for clothing, but clothing is a tool, right? It's a tool for thermoregulation. It's a tool for communication. I think most of what we do with our clothes is more about communication, indicating to people our job, our social status, our interests. But ultimately, mostly what we're doing is just hiding our nakedness. And most of us have developed a kind of shame over time about our bodies that I think wouldn't exist if we would just been naked throughout much of our lives. And so, you know, I would say 80-90% of the time when we're wearing clothes, it's not because we need them for thermoregulation, and it's not because we need them for communication. It's because we always default back to wearing clothes. So again, not saying you should be walking around naked all the time, saying, hey, this is a taboo in yourself, really worth confronting. Get free. All right, number four, and I bring this one up all the time, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but sex. I'm just shocked at how few adults I can have mature conversations with about sex. Particularly, it's not, most of us can talk about sex, but if we want to talk about the specifics of sex or our sex lives, most people get pretty uncomfortable. They get shy, they get silly, they turn red. Especially if we talk about specific sex acts or sexual interests. There's the stuff that's socially acceptable. Oh, she's hot, I'd like to get with her, right? Oh, everybody's okay with that. But if we start talking about real specific stuff, people get strange about it. It's been hidden from us our whole lives. There's that way that, I sometimes think about how there was these stories of like, oh, well, babies, where do they come from? Oh, storks bring them. Like this avoidance of talking about sex, like it's not appropriate for a child's mind. Why is sex not appropriate for a child's mind? It doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Again, sex is the sort of default reality of nature, so it seems to me that it's incredibly appropriate for children. Just like it's appropriate for everybody. Children are made by sex. So, does that mean we sexualize our kids? Of course not. That's not what I'm saying at all. Of course not. But why do we hide it? And is that healthy? I don't think it is. I really don't. If we were to spend any time out in nature, which few of us really did as kids, but if we did, we would have seen things having sex all the time. How often do you see I live in nature, I often see two dragonflies flying by having sex, beetles on top of each other making love. You see animals out in the forest making love. Like, this is not that uncommon. And then our families are making love in our own houses, but they're hiding it. Now, I'm not saying that they should be doing it in front of us or they need to do that or anything like that. Again, I'm just saying that there's this taboo around it where we pretend it's not there or we pretend it's not appropriate. The reality is, every one of you listening to this is going to be obsessed with sex your whole life. I think that's one of the fundamental things we need to just accept. We're going to be obsessed with it always. Even if you're the sort of person who's barely ever had sex in your life, I do occasionally meet people who didn't have sex until their late 30s and 40s. Think those people just didn't think about sex? No, they were obsessed with sex. And they were obsessed with the fact they weren't having sex. Just like the person who's having sex all the time is obsessed with sex. People get older and they're obsessed with if they can still perform sexually. Are they still attractive sexually? Right? It's just that your whole life, you're just going to be obsessed with sex. Learning how to talk about sex, communicate about sex, and developing language around sex, I think, is really important. Not just kind of classical, penis into vagina sex either. I'm talking about the whole gamut. I think we need to be comfortable talking about all the different forms of oral sex, of anal sex, of touching, of male and male sex, female and female sex, group sex. These are all realities of our environment. These are things that are taking place around us all the time. And not being able to talk about it is a sure sign somebody has sexual immaturity. The inability to use both anatomical and I want to say sort of the culturally typical cultural words too. So it's not just being able to say penis and vagina, but being able to say cock and pussy and be able to not turn red and get embarrassed, right? Because that's how people talk. We use those words, right, in common speech. So I think it's being able to communicate about all of that and also being able to communicate about these things to your children when it's appropriate for you to do that. Because, I've experienced and seen a lot of parents who, when it came to time to talk to their kids about sex, just couldn't really do it effectively and left the kids a lot, I think, a little more confused than they started. So I want to encourage you to really get on board with this. It's like, acting like sex, there's something inappropriate about sex is absolutely immature. Acting as if sex is a thing that shouldn't be talked about publicly or socially is absolutely immature, especially in an environment where sex is all around us on every magazine cover, on every in every film, in every commercial, on every billboard. Not every, most. We see it all around us all the time. So we're surrounded in sex, and yet we aren't communicating about it. Which is one reason why it makes for such effective advertising, because we are obsessed with a thing, we don't really dare to talk about it effectively, and so that gets leveraged against us. So I think we need to be really aware of that. So number four, get confident and comfortable talking about sex in a real way, your own sex life in a real way. Number five, money. Oh, this is one where I meet people who have so much development in so many areas. And then when it comes time to talk about money, they become very immature. The more my experience is, the more somebody has explored spirituality, the less comfortable they are talking about money. That to me is unfortunate, because they're stuck on one side of a spectrum, or they're stuck in one end of the pendulum swing. There's a good and evil kind of thing going on here. You know, spirituality is good, money is evil. You know, I thought for a long time money was an invention of civilization, and then I read the book Debt, The Last 5,000 Years, and a fantastic book by an anthropologist who talks about how money comes into existence. I'm not talking about paper money, I'm not talking about currencies as issued by governments, I'm talking about money as a value system. I wouldn't have thought that indigenous people had money, but since I've come to understand that actually money is a spontaneously evolves out of human communication. So let me give you an example. Let's imagine that there was something that we all really liked and valued and was in small, fairly fungible units. Fungible meaning that they're kind of identical units. So let's say that's peanuts. Let's say that we're a culture with a lot of peanuts and we just love peanuts, and we eat peanuts and we eat peanut butter, and we, you know, we like it chunky and we like it creamy. We just love peanuts, right? We like peanuts and everything. We're just a peanut people. And then I want something from you. Let's say you have a vase and I just love your vase, and I really want that vase. And so we might then try to determine its value in peanuts. So you might say, hey, this vase means a lot to me. I'd want at least, you know, 400 peanuts for this vase. And that doesn't mean that I have to go out and get 400 peanuts for you. It's just a way of getting a value of that thing, right? You might say, you know what, Daniel, I really like that cup that you have. And I might say, wow, we might come to a determination, well, that cup's only worth 30 peanuts, right? So maybe we do an exchange. But you don't ever have to give me peanuts. I just know you owe me 30 peanuts. Or I take your vase and I know I owe you 400 peanuts. But later I might bring you something else. And we might value that in peanuts too. And so what happens is a money system comes into being without ever having to actually change hands with that thing. So we hear about the Maya, for instance, using cacao bean as their currency. That doesn't mean everybody was walking around with cacao beans in a little purse and they would actually purchase things with cacao beans. I'm sure that happened in some instances. But probably what's more realistic is we end up with a kind of a debt and credit system where I know how many peanuts I owe you, or how many cacao beans I owe you, or you owe me. And we kind of keep track of that without ever actually having to do the cumbersome thing of transacting with actual currency. Now, switch ahead, what we've ended up with is a kind of government currency, government-issued currency, and that's a whole nother story, and it functions a little bit differently, but let's face it and accept it, we live in that world, and things are being bought and sold with Federal Reserve debt notes, and that includes our time, that includes hours of our lives, right? We all trade our time, our energy for dollars, or the currency that dominates wherever you live. I think we really need to get comfortable with that, because what's really awkward to me is when I want a good or a service from somebody who can't talk clearly about money. So let me think of a great example would be, let's say your hippie friend massage therapist, and you really want a massage, and you know the going rate for massages is $60, and they say, oh, well, you know what, just how about I'll just kind of do it and you just kind of get me back some time? I don't like that. Then I like have this weird debt to a person that's undefined. I don't even know the value of the debt. I would way rather just have a clean transaction. Like, just tell me. And if the person goes, well, how about $40? And you know the going rate's $60? It's like a weird communication. It's like they don't value their own work. It communicates to me that maybe their work's not that good. Right? It's like awkward. It's uncomfortable. I've had to go through this. This was me. I was really awkward about money for a long time, challenged to charge people money for the goods and services that I would provide. Now I'm in a really different place, having had a business for several years now and having traveled around the country and world speaking and doing workshops. And having done it early in without real clear boundaries around money, I learned how often you'll get taken advantage of if you go up to people and communicate to them that they can take advantage of you because you're not clear about how much you need or want. I mean, if you tell me you're going to give me a product or service, but you don't really know how much you want for it, I'm probably going to lowball you on that. Right? I'm going to probably try to get a good deal on that because you're not clear about what your need is. I see this with people in their workplace because they don't dare to ask for that raise they know they deserve. They don't dare to ask for the amount of money they actually really want. I see this a lot is in the farmer's market, where I see farmers feeling really awkward about getting money for the food that they're growing. And sometimes it's like, listen, you got up at 4 o'clock this morning to be to this farmer's market. Like, there's a value there. You have been working sunrise to sunset to make this food grow, to bring it here. I want to have a clean energy transfer with you. I want to have a clean transaction with you. So I see this all the time. People are really afraid to talk about money. People seem really afraid to be clear about money. People feel really afraid to put a price tag on their goods and services. Trade amongst people is very natural and very normal. It's not just an aberration of our modern civilized world. Even in, you know, pre-industrial peoples and in pre-agricultural peoples, trade exists. Usually not in the form of barter. There's a sort of mythology that, oh, we used to all be in a barter system. Not true. Not accurate. And anthropologists know this because they don't go to different societies, you know, that are untouched in, let's say, the Amazon or in India somewhere or in Indonesia and find people who just do barter. It doesn't exist. They do a kind of credit system based on what I was talking about earlier when I first started to share with the peanut analogy there, sort of my poorly executed peanut analogy. People work on a kind of debt and credit system. So it's really important, or often what we see is like a kind of gift-based economy. So regardless, we need to get really clear about money, and we need to be able to talk about it. I mean, this is just so important. And for me, I always notice my aversion to people who can't do that. It feels incredibly immature. It undermines my trust for people. It undermines my trust in their service. And I would rather do a clean transaction with somebody than to be left feeling like I might have ripped them off a little bit, or I might have underpaid them for something because they didn't tell me exactly what they needed. So get clear on money. Just confront it. Just deal. One of the best ways to do that, start your own business. Great way to do that. Number 6, drugs. I talk about this one a lot too, and it's because just about everybody I know does drugs. Some level. Almost everybody I know seeks altered states of... Well, I'll say this. Everyone I know seeks altered states of consciousness. From, you know, 2-year-old little girls that I know who love it when I spin them around until they're so dizzy that they're staggering like a drunk person. To the teetotaler who spends 4 hours a night watching hypnotic television. This is the seeking of altered states of consciousness. We know that animals use drugs. We know animals often seek out altered states of consciousness. And of course, human beings are using drugs all the time in every culture around the world. We've talked about on the show in the past when there are exceptions because there aren't drugs available readily in an environment. And of course, that's pretty rare, but this happens in places like the Arctic. In which case we find that people still seek altered states of consciousness. They just find ways to do it using things like drumming and chanting. In cultures where drugs are a little more frowned upon, let's say monastic cultures, again, we find that kind of chanting thing where people are still finding ways into altered states of consciousness. So the desire to alter our consciousness is normal, and I need this to get across, is healthy. Seeking altered states of consciousness is healthy. There can be unhealthy expressions of that. Absolutely. Just like eating food is healthy, but we sometimes see unhealthy expressions of that, which we might call eating disorders. It's commonly called that. But just because there exist eating disorders doesn't mean we give up food. seeking altered states of consciousness is healthy, and there are aberrations of that, and we call that addiction. But the existence of addiction does not mean that we should give up using drugs in the same way that rape doesn't mean that we need, and molestation doesn't mean that we give up sex, right? And the fact that somebody overeats and then vomits out their food and then overeats again does not mean that we give up eating either. It just does, that doesn't make sense. So addiction is a serious issue. It's touched my life in many ways, and probably if you're listening to this, it's touched your life in some way as well at some point. But that actually has a lot less to do with drugs and a lot more to do with the psychology of the addict and the experiences of the addict and things like community and sense of place. Those have a lot more to do with it than the drug itself. So that said, people use drugs. People have always used drugs. Probably as far back as other Homo species, not just our own. So drug use is found in nature, it's found amongst animals, it's found in indigenous people all over the world. And many things that we consider massive breakthroughs have come as a result of drug use. I think a great example would be the discovery of the double helix of DNA, really being inspired by the use of LSD. That's a fascinating kind of idea to me. I love it when science must admit that one of its scientific breakthroughs came from some sort of mystic experience. That's always really fascinating to me. But again, drugs are incredibly common, and drug use is incredibly common. And even people who say they don't use drugs, you usually find that they consume caffeine, which is, I think, an incredibly strong central nervous system stimulant. And anybody who says it isn't has to be delusional, because if you take somebody who doesn't use caffeine and you give them a good strong dose of coffee, I mean, they're off the wall. I'm off the wall if I do that. So I think that's an incredibly strong drug. Alcohol, obviously another drug. The fact that it gets categorized separately from drugs, I don't even understand that. Tobacco, another really common drug. And then, of course, the massive suite of pharmaceutical drugs that are psychoactive that people are using, but acting like they don't do drugs, even though they're taking a psychoactive prescription in pill form. It's just bizarre to me. So kind of like sex, we don't have good, effective language around drugs very often. People are afraid to talk about it. People feel super... And obviously, one part of that is the fact that we've had a prohibition on drugs. The fact that drugs are illegal and we actually have a so-called war on drugs. A few shows back, we were talking about the drug war and how it actually creates much stronger drugs, how it increases the potency of drugs, because those who are importing the contraband seek more and more concentrated forms of the drug so that their smuggling or dealing can get more people high on the drug with less volume of the drug to have to carry, right? That just makes so much sense. Like, of course, it makes more sense to bring concentrated cocaine powder, you know, into the United States than it does to bring, you know, bags and bags and bags and bags of the coca leaves you would need to get the same amount of people high on it. And of course, because it's illegal, people seek more and more concentrated forms of the drugs. So the drug war has led to that. It's led to incredible amounts of crime. We see something very similar happening right now on the United States and Mexican border that we saw happening when alcohol was illegal during the Prohibition, and we had the rise of the alcohol gangs, the bootleggers. We have something similar going on now with the cartels in Mexico who profit from this drug war. And we had the same thing when we had people profiting from the alcohol war. It's easy to look at that stuff and go, oh, look, drugs cause all that. No. The prohibition on drugs, the taboo on drugs, the inability to be mature adults communicating about drugs has caused that. And we need to get really freed up in that. So probably if you're listening to this, you've been inspired by some drugs you've used. Probably if you're listening to this, you've had massive personal breakthroughs using different drugs. I can say for me, I mean, using, especially for me, psychoactive hallucinogens or so-called hallucinogens, psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, cannabis, dimethyltryptamine, DMT from several sources, ayahuasca. These things have had profound impacts on my consciousness, and I think are really important to proper brain development. That's my personal feeling. So, again, if we can't talk about that, we're not really mature adults, right? We're kind of like children who, and we stay that way if we hide from this conversation. I know that it's challenging because they're illegal, and so we need to be thoughtful about how and where and what we share. But when we're not hanging out with DEA agents, we're with, one another, I think that we need to be able to communicate about this, just like we need to be able to communicate about sex. Number seven, death. Wow, that's a big one. That's one of the biggest ones. I can only think of one that's bigger. So, death. Stop running from it. You can't outrun it. You're gonna die. You are gonna die. And talking about it does not attract it. Right? Talking about the fact that we'll die isn't gonna bring it any sooner. Communicating about death isn't something we need to be afraid of. But that's what we see. We see sort of similar to when I brought up violence, people are afraid to talk about death because they're so afraid of dying. And we live in a culture with no death education. We live in a culture that doesn't explore death. And we live in a culture that wants to explore, water found on Mars, but doesn't want to explore what happens when we die. That is bizarre to me, right? We want to go to the bottom of the ocean. We want to go to other planets. We want to figure out how black holes work, but we're not even communicating about what happens when we die. I can't even really get my head around that. I'm so interested in what happens in death. I'm so interested in the process of death. But we run from it, we hide from it, and we dislike things that remind us of the fact that we're going to die at some point. I'm all for living in ways that build health, and I'm all for ways of living that slow down how quickly we age biologically. Obviously, we can't slow down how much we age chronologically, but we can slow down how we age biologically. I like that idea a lot. I'm really into it because I want quality of life. But if we make the focus trying to avoid death, then we're living in fear. Right? Our life becomes about the fear of death. Most people act like they don't think about death all the time, and the reality is they're actually obsessing over death all the time, but at the subconscious level, and they're doing it by trying to push death away. And you've probably noticed throughout your life that aversion and attachment are very closely related, right? So it's funny, it's like you could have a person who's, let's say somebody who's vehemently trying to get rid of drugs, right? We're talking about that taboo. Somebody who's obsessing over just they gotta stop drugs. Well, what's the reality? They're obsessed with drugs. They don't use them, but they're obsessed with them, right? All their day is about drugs, their nights are about drugs, their life's about drugs, 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 drugs. And they might not realize that. They might think they're out there trying to stop the people who are obsessed with drugs. When you try to push something away all the time, it's because you're obsessed with it, right? So, I was kind of trying to indicate that before. Somebody can grow up and live their adult life and never have sex. That doesn't mean they're not obsessed with sex, right? This means they're obsessed with not having it. I don't know. It's a strange, aversion's a strange thing. So, running from death doesn't make sense, and you can't outrun it, right? You're gonna die. So why not embrace that? Right? Why not develop a culture around ourselves that embraces that? Why not start exploring it? I would love to see death explored more scientifically. I would love to see culturally it get explored more. And for us to just kind of have a culture where we live with the conscious, not subconscious, knowledge that our death is coming. I think that would really influence how we live. I mentioned at the beginning of this that I got around the sun for the 37th time, and I see some tremendous changes in how I'm approaching my life right now, as I start to realize that if I were to live out a normal chronological lifespan, in other words, if I didn't die younger than what is, I guess we could say, the average, that even still, I'm getting closer and closer to it. I don't have that same feeling I had in my teens and my 20s where it just felt like death was never even gonna happen to me. It happened to other people, all that kind of stuff. We hear about that all the time. So it's really changing for me. And as I get more and more, as I become more aware of my mortality And as I accept it more and more, and as I meditate on it more and more, and I learn to embrace it more and more, it actually is relaxing my nervous system. So again, I think a lot of people are afraid that if they look at things, they're going to live in a kind of terror. But the reality is they're already living in the terror, right? The death terror. And looking at it and reaching out and touching it and sniffing it and smelling it, being around it, thinking about it, meditating on it, actually makes the thing less scary, much less scary. So it's like that shadow in the dark room that looks like a monster, and when you really get around it and inspect it, you realize it's like a crumpled up coat on the floor. It's like that. It's like a shadow monster. One sort of unfortunate thing is we don't have, unlike so many natural humans, unlike so many indigenous peoples, we don't have this idea really that we're going to go be with our ancestors. That death is a place where we get reunited. Of course, we have these like sort of childlike heaven and hell stories and all this kind of ridiculous, you know, slave mind control ideologies. But I think most people don't really believe that stuff. You know, you have the holdouts who claim to. I don't think most of us really believe that now. And so we're just kind of left with a nothingness. Science has kind of just given us a, well, you just die and that's the end, and it's oblivion. It's oblivion. I'm like, oh, okay. It's very nihilistic in its approach. And it would be nice if we had some kind of cultural way to approach this. We don't. It means we have to make it up for ourselves. So you're going to have to determine for you what death means for you. For me, it means a kind of graduation into a next stage of maturity, even if it is oblivion. Even if it is oblivion, because it is inevitable. So I'm going to graduate through this process. I am going to enter that initiation. One of the reasons that I promote taboo number 6, which is drug use, is because drug use actually is one of the ways we can start to explore the rough edges of our death. Because we can explore the temporary obliteration of our consciousness. And I think that's incredibly valuable. So people who can't talk about death, that is, by the way, one of the most common things. People are able to talk about death like, oh, my dog died or my grandma died. But people who can't really go into looking at their own death and communicate about that effectively, again, to me, immature and seem like children. And I think a good sign of adulthood and maturity is not the acceptance that death exists, the acceptance of one's own death. And in the health scene and in the nutrition scene, it's so common to meet people who claim to be all about living but are actually just terrified of dying. And so they're doing all of these practices in the hopes of creating some kind of immortality. And they don't maybe know that. And so that's another thing I'll notice is I'll see that and I'll feel sort of sad for that person. Like, oh, they don't even know what they're doing. They're just running and running. And it's kind of sad because have you ever noticed that when you hear about really long-lived people, this is another really common one, you'll hear that news story of like so-and-so in Russia, she's lived to 115 and they interview her, what's your secret? And she's like, well, I smoke 2 cigarettes a day and I always have a glass of vodka in the evening and I love dark chocolate bars. It's like, wait a second, so she doesn't do saunas and skin brushing and naked sunbathing, and she's not going to hot springs and drinking spring water, and she's not, you know, she doesn't have a kind of exercise modality or yoga that she does, she's not a meditator. It's like all these things that we do have to be about quality of life because they are not necessarily going to allay your death. I have yet to hear a story of some long-lived person that's verifiable that did all that kind of stuff to prolong their life. I haven't yet seen that. I hear stories about, you know, these supposed characters in India who are great sages who do all these yogic practices and stuff. I have yet to see like a news story on that person or some verification of that. Whenever I hear verification of some very long-lived person, it's they're not doing those kind of health practices. They're living in sort of traditional ways, usually in parts of the world that are known for longevity. They have good genetics. They have more traditional diets. But even still, it's not like they avoid everything that's we think of as promoting death. They just I don't know. They have good attitudes. They're happy. They live in healthy places. They have family, community. Those things seem to do a lot more than a lot of the practices. So I think a lot of times people are using those practices to, in some kind of childlike hope that they could somehow be immortal. I think we really need to set that aside. And again, I think these practices are good if they increase our quality of life. But one of the sad things is a lot of people are doing all these practices and it's not, they're overdoing it. They're so obsessed with it. They're putting so much energy into it that it actually is taking away from their quality of life. And I think that's incredibly sad. So all that comes from fear of death. And that is probably one of the most fundamental human fears, if not the fundamental human fear. And that's the fear that gets leveraged by religions and by governments to enslave us and enslave our minds. And that brings me to taboo number 8, which is a really healthy conversation about God. I think this is one that has been painted in such a kind of silly caricature light. It's like, first off, I think it's really ridiculous that we have this idea that there's either evolution or creation, and that's it. This kind of dichotomy has been set up where it's like Republican, Democrat. You believe either in this ridiculous creation myth or this other ridiculous creation myth. So you either have to believe like an old man in the sky with a beard created us in 6 days and then on the seventh he rested, or you have to believe that nothing exploded and then became everything and then just life just emerged out of that. Both seem like creation myths. Neither one seem very realistic to me at all. The fact that they fight over this is just endlessly entertaining to me. I think we really need to ask ourselves if when we experience nature, and I don't just mean when you're out walking in nature, but I mean as a very intelligent ape who has explored its universe as much as we have been able to, does that nature communicate to us a design? To me, it does to a degree. I think that there's I'm left with the impression that there is a kind of architect or an architecture. How about that? There's an architecture. So I ask myself, who's the architect? Now, I don't mean in any way some kind of ridiculous man in the sky story at all, or any kind of anthropomorphic anything. I would say I'm more of an animist. I think that there's a sort of sacred livingness to everything. I don't know what that is, and one thing I've come to understand is that anybody who says they know what that is a liar. Anyone who tells you they know anything about God is lying. Anyone who tells you they know about how the universe was created, whether through stories of Big Bangs or through stories of, you know, spontaneous creations by some anthropomorphic godhead, is lying. I mean, how I put so much energy into searching myself in the world for some kind of explanation for any of this, and no matter where I look, I mean, there's just nobody knows. And yet you have all these characters who profess to know, and when you press on them how they know, almost always it's going to be because either a book that they read, or a school they went to, or a transmission from some other person who knew this. In other words, they're making it up. They're lying. Or they really want it to be true. We do have to ask ourselves this question because it seems to really inform how we live, right? It seems to really inform how we live. So it's pretty uncomfortable to talk about right now because of religion. Religion has made the world so awkward around this that most of us have really pushed away, don't want to have anything to do with the conversation. And then I really can sympathize with the world of science and why they're so against any kind of conversation about a creation, because they're still reeling from the pushback that they received from religion. They've only just gotten a foothold. They've only just been able to communicate openly about science, to be only just recently been able to really explore the scientific method without persecution. So, of course, things are a little touchy on the scientific side as well. But I think as a people and as a community, this conversation is really important. A lot of us probably have arrived at the realization that we choose to believe in the sacred because to not believe in the sacred feels like there's something fundamentally missing for us. And for me, and you might have heard me say this on the show before, the idea that the most intelligent form of life that we know of is just ourselves is like it's incredibly sad to me. Right? We hear sometimes that the human mind is the most complex and sophisticated structure in the known universe. Wow, I don't really feel so great about that, given our incredible tendency to fumble and foible. So I would like to believe that there's a more intelligent force at play. The universe itself seems to be quite intelligent and seems unlike what we hear in this sort of second law of thermodynamics entropy story that everything tends towards decay. Looks to me like the universe also tends towards high levels of order. I see that all around us. I mean, your body is an incredibly orderly structure, and somehow that comes together. The universe does tend towards order as well as disorder. What's causing that? What is that? What are all these forces in the universe? What is light? What is gravity? What is the strong force holding together, you know, atoms? What is this? And is there a sacred nature to it? Whether there is or there isn't, it seems that natural humans have all sort of arrived at a similar conclusion, that the whole thing is sacred, that every part of it is sacred, that there is no such thing as the profane. So we have that again, that dichotomy, the sacred and the profane. But I think that the more we feel animism inside ourselves, the more we feel that everything is sort of resonating and vibrating with the same sacred energy, the less there is anything profane. What's profane? You know, many of the topics we talked about today. So shitting, for instance, I brought up. There's a tendency to think of shitting as profane. Well, can shitting be sacred? I don't know. If you live in the world of animism, then shitting would be sacred, wouldn't it? Is violence sacred? If it exists in a world of animism, then it's pretty sacred. Death seems incredibly sacred to me. Sex seems incredibly sacred to me. Can money be sacred? I think it is, because I think it's the exchange of energy between people. Nakedness certainly seems sacred to me, as certainly what would be, I mean, clothes don't seem sacred. It seems, I guess, any more than nakedness. So it just seems like, yeah, drugs, yeah, for sure. I just think we live in a world of sacredness, with everything sort of vibrating with the mystery of aliveness, and we don't really have an explanation for it. So beware people who claim to have an explanation for it. Beware people especially who get specific about that. I think when people are really specific about God or creation, it's like the more specific they are, the more they're lying and deluded, the more confused they actually are. So be weary of that. Wary of that, and be particularly wary of your own tendency to want to get too specific about the nature of our universe or our world. Or at least say, I feel this, I think this currently, but I don't have any way to confirm that other than my own experience and feelings. We gotta be really careful about projecting that onto others. But I think that when we start to get comfortable with the idea of death, then it does sort of... The next question, and the reason I saved it for the end, is, well, what's after death? Is there more? Is this a sacred experience? Is there a higher level? Is there another level? Is there another experience coming? Is there a return to the force that created us? Is there a return to the architect? There's sort of been that idea emerging in science that what we live in may actually be a kind of simulation. There are signs throughout the universe that this may be a kind of simulation, in which case what we think of as the universe could be a kind of almost video game. If so, then the architect could be some kind of pimply random geek programmer. Oh my gosh. What made him? The question goes on and on, right? Who made that guy? So on and on and on and on, this question about whether there's a supreme deity, whether there's a godhead, whether there's an architect, is one we can't ever seem to really get a specific answer to. But it is a question that I think is on the minds of most people somewhere in their subconscious, if not right on the tip of their tongue. And I think that it's unfortunate right now that it's awkward to communicate about it. And I would like to see that taboo go away, because I would say of everything that I've ever been interested in my life, that's the number one most pressing thing to me. Because if I have a creator, I want to be in good relationship with that creator. I want to be at least in good relationship with the rest of the community of life and with the fabric of the universe. I want to be in good relationship to that. And I want to always be getting, I always want to be more and more open and willing. And if we're not able to have that conversation with each other, then this is all playing out behind our eyelids, right? This is all playing out inside our heads and quiet, in the quiet recesses of our minds. And if we're all doing that, then we might as well just get out there with it and have the conversation. So, okay, so recap. Number one, diet, and I include with diet, shitting. The whole process. Just, we got to grow up around it. Two, violence. We just got to accept that it exists and that it's always going to exist because things need to eat. Three, nakedness. You're sitting here listening to this naked. You just probably have clothes on over it. Get over it. Four, sex. Admit it. You're obsessed. Me too. We all are. And we're always going to be. And if we weren't, that we would not perpetuate our species, and nor would any other species. So we're supposed to be obsessed with it. That's actually healthy and normal and super important, and we need to develop language around it. Five, money. Make peace with money. Make peace with money. You know, however you need to do that, because you live in a world where money is the principal form of trade. So, you know, you kind of need to if you want to be a fully functioning adult human. Six, make peace with drugs. You're using them anyway. You know, even if you don't take chemical drugs or you know, botanical drugs or fungal drugs, you know, if you're sitting here listening to this podcast, it's because you like what it does to your brain waves. So, you know, we are seeking out altered states of consciousness. I think that's something we can definitely make peace with. Number seven, death. That's one of the big ones. It's driving human behavior. And when we take that from the subconscious to the conscious, I think we become incredibly powerful and whole people. And number eight, God. Wow, the big one. We need to be able to have that conversation without people getting so tense, awkward, uncomfortable, without them needing to proselytize, or without them needing to reject or push back. And I don't just mean religious people. I also mean scientific people. We need to be able to have that conversation. That conversation was incredibly common for humans all throughout time, and we're currently in a really awkward phase around it. So I think we need to really just be able to make peace with that. So again, to conclude, I think being a fully formed human, an adult human, you need to be able to communicate about all eight of these things effectively. And if you can't, you've got some work to do. And for those of us who can communicate about them, there's always more work to do. We always get more mature. We can embrace things more. We can go deeper into them. We can learn more about them. So we've all got a lot of work to do because we are starting from the kind of deficit that our civilization, our factory farm for humans has created and engendered for us. And it's on each of us to become feral, to rewild our minds, to rewild our speech, our language, our how we communicate, and to be able to look everywhere without fear. And what I mean is lots of these topics we talked about today cause fear for people, so they don't look. And often, like I joked about earlier, we'll call ourselves conscious. That's such a cool buzzword right now. Oh, he's so conscious. And it's like, no, consciousness means being able to be awake and alert and to look. And so if we're not looking at these eight things, and there's a suite of other things as well, I mean, these are the eight that I picked for today, but if we're not looking at these things, we can't call ourselves conscious. And I don't even know that we can really think of ourselves as adult humans. So I just want to encourage you to be bold, be fearless, and I hope this inspires you to do that. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for your support of this podcast. What an opportunity it's been for me the last year and a half to get to share my voice and get to share the voices of so many amazing experts who've come on and supported this show. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for the awesome comments you leave on Facebook. Thank you for the amazing comments you leave on iTunes. They're really inspiring to me. I read them every week, and really makes me smile to see how you've been affected by the show. So know that you're really appreciated. Okay, tune in next week for another episode of the Rewild Yourself podcast. Show your teeth.